Well, hey, welcome back to Country Fried Rock. We dug out a couple of old hard drives, found some of these old episodes from 2009 through 2020, and figured, what the hell, y'all should hear them. Ton of fantastic musicians and bands, many of whom are still out there making great music. I decided to just throw some of these old episodes back out there. They have not been re-edited, so half these places don't even exist anymore. Never mind the URLs, don't even bother. But a lot of these bands really made great music, and I want you to hear it. Dig them up on your favorite streaming service if you can't find them elsewhere, and go see a show if they're still playing. So if you're new to Country Fried Rock, starting back in 2009, this was a syndicated radio show that aired in more than 50 markets across the globe. The structure follows some of the format of older syndicated radio programs, and we left it that way. So we'll bounce around back into the archives and let us know if there's anybody in particular you'd like us to try to dig up off these extremely disorganized hard drives. No matter what, we sure appreciate you being here. You can toss some money in the tip jar or what the hell, join the fan club. But it's most important that you check out this music. It's all there for you these days on countryfriedrock.com and your favorite podcast app. Tell a friend, smash that follow button, and give us a 5-star rating and review. That hasn't changed, no matter how much my hair color and eyeglasses have. Thanks for being here. Hey, y'all, it's Sloane Spencer. Thanks so much for finding all these new old episodes of Country Fried Rock. I've got something completely different available these days called Sleep with Rock Stars. And it all started from a listener comment back in the very early days of Country Fried Rock who said, you know, I slow these down to 75% and fall asleep to them. And I was like, well, over the years, I started thinking about it, and I recently started Sleep with Rock Stars. It's the Gen X Sleep Podcast, and you can find it at sleepwithrockstars.com or your favorite podcast app.
Welcome to Country Fried Rock, where we talk with musicians to find out what inspires their creativity. Country Fried Rock, music uncovered. My guest this morning on Country Fried Rock is Graham Sharp of Steep Canyon Rangers. Good morning.
Good morning, Sloane. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate you being here with us. Well, this has been a treat to get to chat with you. I actually know y'all originally from Asheville, Brevard, kind of Western North Carolina area.
Yeah, we've made our home up there for about the last 10 years or so. Everybody kind of lives up in that area, which is really convenient for traveling and getting together and all that good stuff. Great community up there.
And very strongly supportive of bluegrass.
Yeah, there's a great, you know, traditional music scene up there, and that's kind of what drew us there in the first place, you know, back shortly after the turn of the century.
Let's back up a little bit. How did you get into music as a fan originally?
You know, my first real introduction to bluegrass, I think, was I had a teacher in high school who at one point recommended that I check out Norman Blake, who still to this day one of my favorite guitar players, songwriter, singer guys. So the only thing I could find by him was this Telluride,
right?
1976 Telluride collection. It had the, you know, had John Hartford on it, and
yeah,
had Hot Rise on it, had Newgrass Revival on it, and those kind of were sort of touchstones that I listened to in bluegrass.
As an early listener to that, what was appealing?
I like kind of the directness of the music. You know, I really just like the rootsy feel to it. I loved all the voices singing together, you know. I love the speed of the music. The instruments were really exciting. I don't know. I think I just loved everything about it.
And so then how did that develop for you?
A couple years later, probably around 97 or so, I bought a banjo when I was in college in Chapel Hill at the University of North Carolina. I had actually known Woody and Charles, our guitar and bass player. I had known them before that, or friends and acquaintances, and I don't think either of them owned an instrument at the time either, but I got a banjo, and Charles started taking bass classes at UNC, and he had played bass in school a little bit before, but hadn't played any bluegrass or anything like that. So we'd go down to the music building there on campus, and that's where the bass was. He couldn't take it out of the building, so we'd just go back in the stairwells of the school building there, down near the elevators or wherever, and play music. And it actually turned out to be a great place to play because that's where the musicians were at the school. So we ended up meeting a couple of the other early members of the Rangers there who actually had experience, you know, with the music. That was really nice.
Was there a traditional music scene in Chapel Hill at the time?
You know, not so much in Chapel Hill itself, you know. I mean, we kind of felt like we were sort of on an island, like with a bluegrass band. But, you know, right around that area, I mean, if you take a quarter mile out of town in any direction, you're going to start running into these amazing players, you know. I mean, there's just a, I mean, that's really the hotbed for the music is traditional players. There's a great old-time scene down there.
Right.
A great tons of great bluegrass players right around the Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, Burlington, all the way through that stretch of North Carolina. You know,
yeah.
It's really surrounded by it. But at the time, we had no idea. It took a couple years, I think, for our eyes to be open to the fact that, oh, we're actually surrounded by this world of music that we never even knew was there. Hey, this is Graham Sharp from the Steep Canyon Rangers, and you're listening to Country Fried Rock.
So how did that expand for you all?
Well, I guess at some point Charles bought a bass. Kind of from the start, we were just wanted to learn the music. We were all totally new to it, and that's all we were in it for, you know, was to kind of figure out how to do that. So we were, you know, we were writing our own music pretty early on from the start. Once we could get through a handful of songs, we just, you know, got a bar to let us come play in the corner one night. We were obviously very lucky from the beginning because we had all our college buddies there. So first show was like sold out, jam-packed, and, you know, we probably played the same five songs over and over again. Nobody cared.
And so then when did it expand beyond the college scene?
Well, for me, starting out with that, with the Telluride CD and that being my starting, you know, and for other reasons, we sort of ended up gravitating towards Colorado, sort of the music scene out there. You know, we went out there, we'd go out to that festival, just drive out to the Rocky Grass Festival.
Yeah.
Out of the Lions every year. Just love that festival. And played in the band competition. And one year we won the band competition. We were just like, wow, okay, well, this is cool. So we just sort of kept at it, and I think that cemented it in a lot of our minds that we could, you know, I don't think any of us really thought we'd play professionally, but, you know, just that, you know, we keep the band going. Kind of kept at it, kept traveling around and playing kind of regionally, and one thing led to another, and before you know it, we were doing it full time.
What led to the first record?
Well, we had a dobro player playing with us time. He was from Kentucky, and he knew Curtis Burt, the original Newgrass Revival. He said that Curtis would come help us out and make a record, so, you know, we couldn't believe that. We were totally amazed. You know, we drove up to Glasgow, Kentucky, it was. Drove up there and had about 4 or 5 days in the studio and got the record done and got to hang out with Curtis, which was awesome and amazing. He's a great guy, great player. I don't know if we would have made the first record if not for that, but, you know, we had all those songs. It's all originals. I think there might be one Bill Monroe song on there. And I don't know. It all seemed really natural. You know, we were just a group of friends who were just sort of continuing what we've begun. It just sort of progressed naturally.
Things have moved and progressed quite a bit for you all since that first album.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we probably put in 20,000 hours practicing together as a band. Kind of once we decided we were going to do it, pretty much went after it. We didn't have the luxury of, you know, a lot of people in bluegrass have of, you know, growing up playing the music or maybe playing with a, serving an apprenticeship, which is kind of the standard in bluegrass. Having an apprenticeship with a more established act. We never had any of that. It was just kind of us. Learn how to do it. So around 2000, we all just moved into a house together, sat around and listened to records and played music for 3 or 4 years.
What were y'all listening to?
Everything. Rock and roll. I listened to a lot of blues, Zydeco, songwriter stuff. Obviously, a ton of bluegrass, first generation, Jimmy Martin, all that stuff. Spent a lot of time trying to learn to play the banjo like J.D. Crow. And so that was a lot of my musical education. But, you know, I think a lot of it was just learning how to sort of have our own identity also.
And that is something that, to me, is very distinct and has gelled for you all for quite a long time, is you can listen to something and immediately know that's a Steep Canyon Rangers song.
Right. We didn't really have the opportunity to, you know, learn it from somebody who learned it from somebody who learned it from somebody. So much as we tried or would have liked to have sounded like some of those bands, it wasn't really an option for us. We just kind of had to end up sounding like ourselves.
Several great musician friends of Country Fried Rock generously donated songs for a free music sampler. Download it at noisetrade.com/countryfriedrock. 19 songs to help raise awareness and money for Nucci Space, a nonprofit serving the mental health needs of musicians in the Athens, Georgia area. Find out more about Nucci's at nuci.org. I hear a lot of the songwriter influence, which is not always the case in traditional music.
Yeah, I mean, we try really hard, you know, not to necessarily follow a formula for anything, you know. We have a song, and if we like the song, we sort of try to treat it as a song and not try to fit it into a certain niche or a certain genre. But, I mean, that said, bluegrass is the foundation, so
sure.
It's kind of the touchstone for the whole thing, but it all just kind of grows out of that.
So how does that develop for you all when you're working up new material?
Sometimes it can be fast, sometimes it can be slow, you know. The writer, myself or Charles, usually will bring a song to the band and just kind of toy around with it, you know. I mean, change the key, change the chords, change the time signature. I mean, that's the fun thing about being in a band like this is that, you know, you have a lot of flexibility and nobody's going to judge you or, you know, anything like that. We all are working for the common goals. You know, if it takes 10 minutes to get a song how you like it, or if it takes 5 years to get a song how you like it, you know, I mean, that's kind of what we're all in it for.
As much as you're on the road, is that a time when you can then work up songs, or is that a time when that's put aside for a while?
Yeah, that's definitely the time when we work on stuff. You know, we get a lot of time in hotels or in our van that we can do all that. And for me, that's actually when I get most of my writing done, is when I'm on the road. It's a really good time for us. It's always refreshing whenever you get the juices flowing and feel like you really hit on something. You know, that's a good feeling.
A lot of times you hear people segment those bits of creative time into separate things. So that's working more symbiotically for you all.
Yeah, we've all got pretty busy home-wise. I've got family and two children, and Charles does, and Mike's got a young son, and Woody and Nikki have a lot going on around home, so it kind of works for us. So when we're on the road, that's time we can really devote to it.
Sure. Well, so a lot has changed for you all from that first record and developing what your own individual distinct sound was, and you've had some nice little sidetracks on the way there. What's kind of transpired in a nutshell up to now?
Well, about 3 years ago, we started working with Steve Martin, you know, traveling with him, probably doing about 40 or 50 shows with him over the years. And, you know, I mean, we had done four other Steep Canyon records between that time and felt like we were, you know, in a pretty good spot as a band. But, you know, working with Steve is just gets a different level of media exposure. It's been huge for us. And I think musically, it's really sort of refocused us a little bit on the Steep Canyon Rangers, you know, kind of on what we do well and what our strengths are. And Steve has really been good for that, you know, I think, to encourage us maybe more to play to our, you know, what really are our strengths. Check out the Steep Canyon Rangers at www.steepcanyon.com.
Yeah, I've spoken with several bands who have had nice little side things that have really increased the exposure to their music. What has that changed for you all?
You know, I don't think it's changed a lot. You know, we've coming into our last record, we recognized that it was probably going to give us a chance to gain a little bit wider audience for it. That was a good feeling. I think it really focused us, you know, going into making it Nobody Knows You. I think it really sort of just encouraged us to be that much more creative.
As you are heading in to make a new record, do you go in with a batch of songs already?
We do. Yeah, I mean, we go in with probably, I don't know, we probably had 10 or 12 songs ready, and then probably four or five others that were in various states of readiness. And kind of just depending on how things were going and how the album was shaping up was what we kind of decided to use as we went along. We probably had 8 or 9 songs that we were pretty sure we were going to record. And then after that, it's just seeing what fits and what kind of direction, what kind of flavors and stuff you want to add in from there.
Are you all road testing new material before recording?
Yeah, I mean, we were doing that right now for another record. Constant process. Once a record comes out, you know, those are songs you've written a year or two ago. You know, by the time you've recorded it and released it and done all that, it's always sort of a game playing catch up like that.
What's different for you all now with what will be new material?
For us, I mean, we've always seen ourselves this way, and I think always will. I mean, we're still learning, you know, we're still trying to get better, just write better songs, play better, sing better, and just sort of keep growing, you know. It's kind of been the main thing for our band, you know, and that doesn't necessarily mean to like do like experimental music or anything right. Like that. It just means, you know, not to say we're going to do this or this, or be beholden to this and that, just to, you know, follow where our folly leads us.
Keep it fresh.
Yeah.
What would you all like to bring into a recording process that you have not done yet?
I think right now we've had some really great producers in the past. I think now, you know, we may be just trying to look to a producer who has like a really distinct sort of flavor to add, something that's going to really mold an album together, give it a lot of continuity, I think.
The role of a producer with any kind of traditional music can be somewhat different than, say, you're bringing in a rock and roll band and you're going for like that producer's sound. How does that work for you all?
For me, a lot of it just has to do with setting, you know, just getting the band in the right setting and getting it, just capturing the sound the way we want it to be. That said, you know, we're also a little bit off traditional, so a lot of tweaking and arranging we can kind of do within our music. We've always done pretty much, you know, 99% of that ourselves within the band and continue to. You know, it's also something where if you're in a position to take advantage of somebody has made a lot of great music, why not do that? You can buy Steep Canyon Rangers music at steepcanyon.com.
What type of environment do you all like when you're in that recording mode?
We've done different ways. I think different things have worked at different times. For our next one, we're just kind of going to try to look at just setting up a few mics in a room and try and laying it down as it goes. live. That's kind of what we're looking towards. We've done records like that. We've done records, you know, tracked out too. So I think both can work. But right now, I think the feeling for us is to go to a more, you know, just a live in the studio kind of setting.
How do you feel about songs and their life as a recorded product versus their life as a live product?
Well, I mean, when you're recording, you're really just trying to capture a moment, you know? I mean, nothing's cemented as far as the songs go. You know, I mean, our songs still change on how we do them and stuff like that. So you're never, you know, you're not setting it down necessarily for eternity how the song is. You're just trying to capture a good moment in that song, really.
Are there any in particular that stick out to you as that have changed quite a bit?
I would say, you know, Between Midnight and the Dawn is sort of constantly changing a little bit. Natural Disaster as well. You know, it's just sort of product of different playing a song live versus playing it, you know, for a record. You kind of have to just respond to those two things a little differently, I think.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention this because it also got an IBMA award recently. When I first got this record, I was absolutely taken with the packaging. I like the tactile part of music. That's part of it to me. But how did that process develop?
Yeah, it's a great company that actually is really wonderful for us. They're out of Dallas called Bedrock. And we came to know the owner of that through some film work that Steve was doing. You know, as a way of thanking us for working on that project with them, he sort of offered their services for graphic design and all that. I mean, they're just wonderful, wonderful graphic designers. You know, I think they really understand the feel of the music and, you know, translate that in a really smart way onto the page. So, yeah, those guys, wonderful.
That was a perfect way to explain it. The feel of the music in both internally as well as the physical product.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm like you. I like the physical product too. And, you know, when something looks how it sounds, you know, it all just comes together right.
What are you all seeing with your music of the difference with people who are consuming it digitally versus other more traditional methods of accessing music?
Well, most of our CD sales are really, you know, what we sell at our concerts by and large. Bluegrass is sort of one of the final bastions of the physical record, as it was. You know, for us, it's been nice. We can offer vinyl with a digital download card in it, which is what a lot of bands are doing, which is really nice. A vinyl record at home, which gives you that physical copy, and the vinyl sounds great. And then you also get a download card, so you can put it on your device and take it anywhere you go.
Not only is the consumption of music changing, or the methods in which people are consuming music, what's changing for you all about the audiences that find you?
Well, you know, I mean, we've always played to very diverse audiences, and that's kind of still the case. They're just a little bit bigger these days. We play in very traditional settings, and we play settings where they don't get a lot of bluegrass bands through there. You know, where our music lies somewhere in the middle, everybody's just kind of appreciative. If we go one place, we're considered a traditional band, and if we go another place, we're considered, you know, a very contemporary band, you know, depending on the audience.
But I hear you about how, depending on who else is on, say, a festival bill or who the crowd is, their expectation and definition of you may be different.
Yeah, 100%.
Do you get a chance to hear much other live music?
We're lucky to get to go to a bunch of festivals and hear a lot of great bands at different festivals. You know, whether it's a bluegrass festival and you get to see a bluegrass band that hasn't seen for a year or so, or we do some other really diverse stuff. We were up in Winnipeg Folk Festival this year, and you know, lots of great traditional music of all kinds up there. So try to get your eyes opened up by it as much as possible. It's all, I think, really good inspiration. Mountain Song at Sea will be cruising out of Miami February 1st through 4th. Lots of the greatest bands in bluegrass and acoustic music. We hope you can join us at sea.
Has anybody in particular caught your ear?
A great soul singer up in Winnipeg. I remember his name, the Flying Eagle of Soul. I can't remember his name, but I don't know. I pretty much like it all when it comes to music, so any chance to see the live stuff is the best.
When you all are out in headlining events, do you all like to have someone you select be an opener?
Sometimes, but you know, sometimes we also take a cue from somebody who's more local who kind of has a feel for it. You know, in general, I think it's better to have somebody who's not another bluegrass band. In my opinion, it always, when we play at a festival where we follow somebody who's not a bluegrass band, it sounds better, you know, a little bit of variety, I think, goes a long way.
Has there been anyone in particular where that's worked real well for you all?
Well, I mean, you know, we always love on the chances where we get to go open for another band. Who's kind of outside of our genre. It's always nice because, you know, the bluegrass takes them by surprise a little bit. That's always a fun thing to do. We don't get to do an awful lot of that. Played a benefit last week with Steve Martin with Paul Simon up in New York. That I guess Paul Simon was there, Stevie Wonder was there, James Taylor was there. And Paul Simon Diamond's great band was doing a lot of music, but you could tell, like, when the bluegrass, when we started playing, you know, it just shifted people's attention a little bit. So it was a really good experience to take it to those kind of settings.
That's very cool. Do you all have any particular causes that you all try to work your music for?
Yeah, you know, our guitar player, Woody's, about 7 years ago, founded the Mountain Song Festival. It benefits the Boys and Girls Club of Pennsylvania County. You know, it has great community support, and it's raised, I think after 6 years, it's raised about $300,000. That's our festival. Like I say, it's raised $300,000 for the Boys and Girls Club of Pennsylvania County. And musicians and stuff like that, and a beautiful country out there.
Gorgeous.
It's about 30 minutes south of Asheville, right on the borders of Pisgah National Forest down there. Yeah, so that's been kind of our main charity that we do. And then when we do our shows in Asheville every year, we started continue theme, but in Asheville rather than Brevard. Last year, we benefited one of the schools there in Asheville, and this year, we're going to have our concerts there benefit two of the other schools.
Well, and Mountain Song has expanded. There's like Mountain Song at Sea or something, isn't there?
Yeah, so this is the first year of Mountain Song at Sea, which is this great production company called Six Man that takes what we're doing at our Mountain Song Festival, but put it on a Norwegian cruise liner in the Caribbean. So yeah, this is the first year for Mountain Song at Sea. It's, like I said, it's kind of a reflection of the music we have at Mountain Song. Obviously ourselves, Dale McCurry and the Travel McCurrys, David Grisman Quintet, Punch Brothers, Kruger Brothers, Della May, Town Mountain, Shannon Whitworth, Larry Keel, lots of folks, you know, that we've just come to, we're lucky we get to, like, for these festivals, we get to choose these bands that we really want to hear and invite them to come play. So, yeah, it's February 1st through 4th, I think, sailing out of Miami. And like I say, it's kind of the first thing of its kind because the whole boat is actually dedicated to the cruise. There's going to be all sorts of music-related events with the bands and stuff like that around. We're really looking forward to it.
Thank you so, so much for your time, Graham. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Sloan. It's glad we finally caught up. I'll do it. Bye.
Country Fried Rock. Find the full playlist from this episode on countryfriedrock.org. Check us out on iTunes. No music, just talk.
Our theme music is from The Full Tones.
Our Country Fried Rock stinger is from Steve Soto and the Twisted Hearts. Country Fried Rock.
Copyright 2012
by Lilypad Productions. All rights reserved.
Ever he been helping us from Country Fried.